morning and welcome to this month's Hancock & Whitney Bank's Economic Update Call. Hancock Bank and Whitney Bank provide this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. If you have any questions, please email them to david.lundgren@hancockbank.com. And today on the call we have Chief Investment Officer John Portwood, Investment Directors David Lundgren, Luther McDougall, Jeffrey Tangus, and Greg Hodleski. With that, I'll pass it on to David Lundgren, who will moderate the call.
Thank you, Ashley, and thank you, everyone, for joining us this morning. Hopefully, everyone had a great Labor Day. John, President Obama is en route to a NATO summit, and I'm sure two of the major topics on the agenda are going to be regarding the Russian-Ukraine situation, and then also the emergence of ISIS in both Iraq and Syria. And, you know, we've talked about the Russian-Ukraine situation, I believe, for probably two or three months in a row now. Bring us up to date is where we are in regards to that geopolitical situation.
All right. If in case anyone hasn't kept up with the news in some detail, Vladimir Putin has referred to the section of southeastern Ukraine that he seems to be intent on occupying or using as a land bridge to Crimea. He's referring to it as the new Russia, which apparently, according to what I've read, has some historical significance as far as the Russians are concerned. Putin still enjoys an 84% popularity rating, I guess, among the Russian people. So, you know, any thoughts anyone might entertain that, you know, the Russians themselves might be getting a little antsy about his incursion, which is what they're calling it now, I guess, from the West into Ukraine, and perhaps stop it is probably, you know, not worth really thinking about at this point. But in any case, there's probably not a great deal the West can do at this point about what Putin is trying to do. Obviously, he's trying to control either directly or you know, indirectly what happens in the Ukraine and maintain a buffer zone, as the Russians have always, you know, liked to maintain between Russia and the West. So, you know, what the West and what NATO can do about this, of course, is probably, you know, a huge question mark. There was some talk over the weekend that some sort of quick reaction force was going to be established, but that's simply to make some of the Baltic states feel a little better about the fact that they're on Russia's border. So, you know, my guess is that when push comes to shove, the Germans who trade about 30% of their goods with Russia and who depend on Russian gas quite a bit will only go so far as sanctions are concerned, and they're not likely to do, you know, anything to push Putin out. So I guess this situation will continue for a while until at some point, unless things really get out of hand, you know, Putin gets his way, he makes a deal with the president of the Ukraine, and he establishes some sort of control or influence that makes him happy. That is the most likely outcome, I think, you know, without some sort of major you know, clash between the Ukrainian army and the Russian army. So obviously that's not good for Europe. It's already had some impact on trade and in the economy of Europe. Any further sanctions that are imposed on Russia, of course, are going to hurt everybody else to some degree, and that's going to hurt economic growth in the European area, and probably impact world trade to a degree. So, you know, none of this is necessarily going to lead to a major shooting war, but of course, it's not particularly positive economically. The ISIS situation in the Middle East, of course, is a continuation of what everybody calls a generational war between the West and radical Islam, and you know, it may take different forms over the years as things go on. But again, calling it a generational war is probably pretty accurate because it's lasted for a long time now, and that's probably going to continue. But you know, it makes the Middle East more chaotic. It takes us back to what things were like 30 or 40 years ago, and when you combine, you know, what's happening in the Balkans with what's happening in the Middle East, you can't help but come to the conclusion that it's probably a negative for world growth and world trade in some respects and will have some impact on the economic outlook. Henry Kissinger, who was Secretary of State under Nixon, wrote a piece recently in which he referred to a change in the world order, or that we have entered a new world order, you know, having been in one since 1989 and the fall of the Berlin Wall, which was geared toward, you know, more democracy around the world, economic growth, so forth and so on. And now we have entered a period of you know, increased tension in world affairs, increased conflict, and probably, you know, something that will have a negative impact on world growth for some time to come. I mean, not necessarily kill it completely, of course, but will have a suppressing effect, I guess, on growth. So that's kind of, you know, where we stand. It looks like this situation is going to be with us for a while and probably, you know, move up and down, I guess, as the situation progresses, but it's probably not going to get, you know, significantly better anytime soon. By the way, the idea that this is going to be a long-term plan, I guess, as far as Russia is concerned and their impact on the Balkans, they made a deal with China that was announced recently. They're going to build a gas pipeline to take Russian gas and I guess perhaps oil to China. Completion date is about 2019. So they're preparing for the long term and preparing for, I guess, a struggle to push Russian interests as far as they can. And I guess we're just going to have to get used to this.
And what is, in the Russia-Ukraine situation, what is kind of the line in the sand that NATO and U.S., you know, where they begin to take military action?
Probably not until Russia begins to threaten Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, you know, some of the other countries that, you know, have large Russian populations, and something that probably directly impacts NATO. I have no idea. I don't think anybody does really what would happen if the president of the Ukraine decides to go into, you know, full-out war, I guess, with the Russians and, you know, use the army to the greatest extent he can. I would not be surprised if we're not talking to the president of Ukraine and saying, look, we'll give you enough money to keep you happy, but don't precipitate anything at this point. I imagine he's being counseled by NATO and even Obama about doing anything precipitous at this moment. So it looks like Putin has the upper hand. He's going to get whatever he wants out of this deal, probably without, you know, a full-scale, you know, military eruption.
Okay. Let's shift gears a little bit and talk about the U.S. economy. We've seen another revision to second quarter GDP. It looks like it's going to come in, you know, pretty solid in that 4% range. I think the last revision was to 4.2%. And the year's flying by. We only have the month of September left in the third quarter. Give us an idea of how the economy is looking, and maybe focus on the major drivers of housing, jobs, and wage growth.
We've talked about housing before, and it appears that housing has entered into a different phase of its recovery from the credit bust and the real estate crash in 2008. And it's one that is more normal in the sense that it is more dependent on first-time buyers and issuing mortgages to people who actually buy houses and live in them. And to this point, until the end of last year, about 30 or 40% of all the sales nationwide were cash sales, and that seemed to be driving the market. And Shiller of Case Shiller Index fame has often talked about the probability that we would enter a more normal phase of the housing market in which housing would slow down considerably and make much slower progress going forward when it had to depend on first-time buyers. And I may have mentioned this before, first-time buyers were about 27% of the market now. Before the crash, they were about 45% of the market. So the first-time buyers really aren't there in any force, and we've seen mortgage rates decline in the last 4 or 5 months, and yet housing has weakened during that period. So it appears that while housing is not likely going to go away completely, there's not going to be a significant amount of strength there to really, let's say, drive GDP beyond growth beyond what we've seen so far. On the job front, we're still plagued with most of the jobs being created in lower wage categories, and you still have a situation where part-time jobs exceed full-time jobs, and that wasn't the case before 2008. So, you know, again, from a job standpoint, it looks like things are improving, you know, gradually, but and at a decent pace. But, you know, the kind of jobs that are being created don't really pay that much on average, and that gets us to the wage growth issue. And you'll remember that we've talked a lot in the last few years about the idea that even though a lot of people expect and hope mm-hmm. for breakout GDP or escape velocity GDP, where we hit a place where we're consistently doing 3.5 to 4% over a period of several years, and you know the underlying data suggested that wasn't going to happen, and it never did. Now the emphasis seems to have shifted to wage growth and the idea that there will be a job shortage, or that there is a job shortage, and there's going to be some sort of, you know, wage gain throughout the economy that will, you know, help drive GDP growth forward. Unfortunately, it doesn't show up yet in new hires, and it seems to be more in a broad sense, more of a hope, I guess, in reality. You're seeing it in the energy area, for example. You know, a water truck driver in the shale gas area can make $70,000-$80,000 a year just driving a water truck back and forth. But it's relatively concentrated, and you don't see it anywhere else in the economy. And a new study came out over the weekend looking at jobs and wages and so forth, and some surprising things came out of that. You know, we always think about engineering and technology jobs as being, say, in shortage and paying relatively high wages, but apparently that's not the case anymore. In fact, I have an anecdotal story about that, about a son of a friend of ours who has a graduate degree in engineering, and he can't get a job in engineering, so that's kind of interesting. I don't know, you know, what the story is there on that particular situation, but it looks like the idea that we're going to get widespread wage gains, you know, throughout the entire economy is probably not likely. So it looks like we're still looking at a 2-2.5%, you know, growth economy if you look at year-over-year numbers through the second quarter. Even with the revision, they're about 2.5%. We've had roughly 2% growth since 2009. So, you know, unless something really significant changes in the basic data that we're seeing, it's probably not likely that we're going to see a significant increase in GDP growth, in the near term. Current estimates have to be taken with somewhat of a grain of salt, because nobody can project out with a great deal of accuracy, but current projections for GDP growth for the U.S. for the entire year are still in that 2% range, I suppose. You know, suggesting that if we get 3% growth in the third quarter and 3% in the fourth, we'll still be probably at about in the twos for the year. So we just have to wait and see. But the current data suggests that, you know, while leading indicators are good, coincident indicators are good, you know, we don't look like we're near recession, it also does not appear that we're, going into economic liftoff, at least not yet.
Well, I guess compared to the Eurozone, we are in economic liftoff. I think they'd be very, very happy with 2-2.5%. I mean, their economy just continues to struggle. And we're hearing more and more talk about the ECB implementing QE. Couple questions, and they're kind of related. Can our economy decouple from Europe? You know, can we continue to grow as we have really for the last few years while they, remained almost flat? And what kind of an impact would QE have on us if it were to be implemented by the ECB?
We do enjoy one advantage as a country economically, and that is that we have a greater ability have had in the past and apparently still have a greater ability to grow on our own without a lot of help from other countries. So to some degree, we do have a certain amount of self-contained activity, I guess, that can keep us growing positively. But recently, analysts have noted that U.S. companies with overseas sales have been underperforming of late, suggesting that people are beginning to get some hint that, you know, earnings are going to be impacted by what's happening overseas. And since the world is so globalized these days, the idea that we could totally decouple from a very soft Europe, an increasingly soft China, and obviously, you know, a Japanese market that is really, economy is not doing that well. The idea that we can decouple completely and certainly get into more rapid economic growth without some help from the rest of the world is probably not likely. So again, it looks like we're probably, you know, doing well to be in that 2-2.5% growth area, while the rest of the world, you know, basically stagnates. And again, to the extent that, you know, sanctions are increased on Russia, it's going to have some impact on European activity, which, you know, to some degree is going to impact what happens here. So now, you know, what about QE in Europe? Draghi lately has sort of toned down his ideas about QE, and the German finance minister last week indicated that they thought there were other things they could implement besides massive QE in Europe. And it gets back to the Germans being afraid of generating an inflationary spiral and generating something that happened in the Weimar Republic back in the 1920s that allowed Hitler to come to power. So the Germans are increasingly, exceptionally concerned about generating inflation, and they seem to be the stumbling block from doing something in Europe from a quantitative easing standpoint to push things ahead. So if they do something, it's probably going to be later rather than sooner, according to the current data. So it looks like Europe is still in a situation of not being able to make a great deal of headway. And, of course, it's not really, you know, written down that they would have, you know, any better luck with QE than we have, really, you know, except, you know, possibly, you know, keeping them alive, you know, longer than might be the case. We don't know how many bad loans they've got over there, for example. You know, we're
right.
Not really sure what that situation is like, but though it may eventually come to that anyway. But in any case, you know, the world growth is slowing, world trade growth has slowed, and it looks like, you know, we're still in a, you know, moderate, relatively, you know, tepid growth environment that, you know, might last again for some time.
Okay. Thank you, John. Stocks, you know, I guess we had a pretty shaky start in that first week of August, and then we just made an amazing comeback, you know, second half of August. S&P 500 closed above 2,000 for the first time, an all-time high at the end of the month. For the month, the S&P 500 finished up 4%, only to be outdone by small-cap stocks. The Russell 2000 was up 5%. International stocks continue to lag a little bit. They were up 0.6%. And so far for the year, S&P 500 is up 9.9%. So just chugging along. And Luther, you there?
I'm here.
You want to give us a little further breakdown on the market for the month, and then we're going to turn it over to Greg.
Yeah, for the month, it was I would call it an extraordinary month, in that, as you mentioned, the market was up about 4%. But if you look at the 10 economic sectors, 8 of the 10 sectors were up at least 3.75% or close to 4%, if not higher, with the best performing sectors being the continuation of the year-to-date move for utilities and healthcare. But we also saw a bounce back on the consumer side, as we saw a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel, if you will, in that the consumer spending was, although it was down, the consumer stocks were up close to 4.5% for the month. So it was, if you will, indiscriminate buying kind of across the board, except for telecommunications, which was down 1% due to a failure of a merger, and then energy was also up only 2.24% as oil prices fell a little bit for the month. So it was an extraordinary month. As I mentioned, for the year to date, we continue to see strength in the utility sector, healthcare and technology. All of those are up 15 to 16%. And the only really truly weak sectors of the market year to date have been industrials and consumer discretionary, which were both up less than 4% after a plus 4% month in August. So it was a very good month across the board pretty much last month. With the continuation of the same trends that we've seen so far this month in the other sectors, or this year in the other sectors.
Great. Thank you, Luther. Now, Greg, Luther and I tackled the easy part on what has happened. Could you give us an idea of maybe what's driving, and then the hard part, give us your outlook on where we're going forward?
Yeah, it's really kind of amazing. I mean, the market continues to charge on and ignores all the geopolitical risks that are out there, but that seems to be the nature of the beast. But I think the market is probably focusing more, you know, we talked, touched on the isolationist nature of our economy and that we're big enough that we can continue to grow. And I think, you know, what I'm seeing is, you know, encouraging economic news out there. It's not perfect. The leading indicators, you know, are particularly bullish, actually, and the stock market is a big component of that, so you have to put that in the context. And housing certainly has had its weak moments, and that's a big component of GDP, but in general, it's still generally strong. But, you know, we're going to have situations where housing pulls back from time to time. As John pointed out, we're not seeing maybe as much participation as we would like. We continue to see improvement in the labor markets. Again, you know, the caveat there is that, you know, we would like to see higher-paid full-time jobs, but it is still jobs, and, you know, it still promotes spending, so we'd rather have people working part-time rather than, you know, than collecting unemployment checks. So, and manufacturing heats up. In fact, just while we were talking here, a headline came across, U.S. manufacturing and construction sectors roar. So, you know, we're seeing some pretty good strength there. Capacity utilization, which is, you know, how much we're using our resources, is at 80%, which suggests robust capital growth. And the big story is earnings. Earnings are keeping the P.E. ratio somewhat in line. And so we're seeing strong earnings, and that's really what we need to see from corporate America. As far as the outlook, history suggests that you know, when you've had a positive January through August, September's a pretty good month. So kind of looking positive for the month of September. And since 1926, the S&P fourth quarter returns really have been quite strong at 2.6%. So history, again, suggests that the fourth quarter is a strong strong period. So we might have actually a double-digit year before we hit December 31st. So keep your fingers crossed. I think I've talked on previous calls that, you know, when P.E. ratios are in this 17, 18 times range, which we are right now, that generally has indicated a single-digit return for the year. But, you know, at 9.9%, as you pointed out, we're right there. So, you know, if the rest of the year remains strong, we could see that. Another interesting statistic I ran across last week is that since 1926, that's like 88 years, single-digit returns are actually quite rare. Really, out of that period, time period, 51 years, so just over you know, a considerable amount, you've had double-digit returns between 10 and upwards of higher than 20%. Out of the 26 years have actually been single-digit returns or single-digit losses. And then only 11 times have you seen really double-digit losses during that same time period. The next thing that's kind of the fly in the ointment, and I'm not sure how that's going to play out, are the midterm elections. Generally, those are very positive for the market. The market just, I think, looks at that as change, regardless of political association. I think the market generally likes any kind of political change because, again, they're kind of forward-looking, and you've had this administration for the past 8 years, and I think, if there's a power change, that's generally a positive. The one thing that does bother me, though, and I think just hearing people talk about the Republican versus Democrat, there's really not any standout, clear person on the Republican side. And I think the Democrats have probably done a pretty good job at demonizing the other side. And so it's kind of a toss-up for me on how these midterm elections, I think a lot of people think that, perhaps the Republicans are going to get both the Senate and the House. I'm not so sure about that at this point. So that could be a fly in the ointment there. Again, just touching on PEs, it's not the cheapest market that we've seen, so, there's certainly concerns. If you just look at decades going back to the 1930s, I pulled up some information. In the 60s, we averaged about 18 times earnings. In the 70s, we were at about 13 times earnings. During the 80s, about 12 times earnings. In the 90s, of course, where we had the tech bubble, we were almost at 20%, or I should say 20 times earnings. Same with 2000s. And again, we're at about 17.8, 18 times earnings. So historically, not necessarily cheap, but then again, we're not necessarily in bubble territory. I hate the term TINA, but, with interest rates continuing to remain quite low and a lot of questions, regarding when the Fed is actually going to raise rates, stocks seem to be, again, the only game in town. And in terms of relative value, stocks seem to be a little bit more favorable in terms of, obviously, just in nominal returns. But given P.E. ratios, it's really not in bubble territory, probably. Is there a chance of a pullback? Absolutely, there always is. Will the market take a look at the geopolitical situation? I think the whole issue in Russia, if actual military action, that could certainly could trigger a sell-off. But that is, seems very unlikely that that's going to escalate. And so bottom line, I'm still pretty positive on the stock market. Are we going to have some pullbacks? Absolutely. But in general, still like this market.
Thank you very much, Greg. Jeff, bonds actually had a good month as well. We saw our interest rates decline during the month. The 10-year was down about 20 basis points from 255 to 235. You want to give us some just general color around the bond market for the month?
Absolutely. Well, John Portwood touched on a lot of the reasons. The geopolitical tensions around the world caused a flight to quality, people seeking safety in the U.S. dollar, and then that money normally finds itself into U.S. Treasury securities, and so that's what drove the yield down on the 10-year. Certainly, Ukraine as well as the Middle East, everything that we have going on there, and the uncertainty. Then the other factor was the other point that John touched on, the European Central Bank has been talking up the idea of their own version of quantitative easing. They're dealing with some possible deflation, which is very concerning to everyone in Europe. And so what the European Central Bank is maybe trying to do is revive some inflation to ward off deflation. Mario Draghi has said that he'll use any means he has to, which basically says he'll do quantitative easing, much like we did. And the bond market took that information and ran with it, basically, and said, well, now here we go again. It's pretty difficult for rates to rise anywhere in the world if Europe is aggressively doing quantitative easing and lowering interest rates. So basically geopolitical tensions and the sluggishness in Europe caused a flight to quality in the U.S. Treasuries. The net effect of it was manifested in the German government 10-year bond yields, which dipped under 1%. And again, juxtapose that to our 2.4% 10-year Treasury. So they're at 1 or under 1, and we're at 2.4, that tells you the kind of the kind of demand there was for government securities, especially quality government securities, Germany being the strongest financial member of the European community. There has even been talk that the German bond yield may be more of a significant indicator and set the tone in the market, even though our treasury market is a little less than 10 times the size of the German bond market. People are starting to look at that as an indicator and a tone in the marketplace. For the month of August, the U.S. Treasury 10-year had a total return of 1.95%, a pretty phenomenal one-month return. That is not an annualized return. So far for the year, the Treasury 10-year has returned 7.7%. Much greater than anybody had anticipated. If you think where we were back on January 1, interest rates had just risen on the 10-year to 3%, and people were really anticipating rates to move even higher. So for the Treasury has had just a phenomenal year. You consider that against even some of the weaker members, governmentally speaking, around Europe. Italy is at a 2.45%, Spain a 2.25%. Some of these countries just 6 months or a year ago were dealing with some liquidity issues. And so now we've seen rates decline really around the world in the face of quantitative easing in Europe. Here at home again, on the corporate bond front, a generic five-year corporate bond investment grade yields about 0.5% more than Treasury securities. That's at a really historic narrow spread, the least that it's been since the recession of 2008. And then one more indicator of just the demand in the bond markets. In the high yield area of the bond market, for the month, high yield bonds were up 1.89%. So far for the year, 6.43%, so not quite as good as the 10-year Treasury, but still a very good return. Of course, that was on the heels. The month of July was a down month, so it was a little bit of a comeback month for high yield. But generally speaking, across the board, bonds have had a good month and a good year. I'd say just looking ahead then, it looks like again, using some of John Portwood's economic forecast for our GDP and what's going on in Europe, it's pretty tough to make a case where rates rise dramatically. It appears we're in something of a trading range in between 2.8%, maybe in 2.4%. The 10-year, it looks the consensus for the end of the year is now somewhere around 2.8%. At the beginning of this year, people really thought it would be more like 3.5%. So expectations for the yield, for yields in general, and certainly for the U.S. Treasury, have been coming down as growth forecasts have been cut back and as Europe has talked more about quantitative easing. So the forecast looks pretty stable for bonds, generally speaking. It does appear to be a trading range without any big moves in either direction.
Thank you, Jeff. Luther, you want to wrap up here with just maybe a brief overview of the muni market for us?
Absolutely. The muni market is also having an outstanding year. The broad municipal bond market is up 7.5% year to date. A good month last month, too, with the market up 121. We've seen the same type of move in municipal bonds as we've seen in the Treasury market, with the 10-year municipal bond, AAA GO, started the year at about 3%. Now we're down to 2.17%. We've got, as Jeff mentioned, all the same factors impacting the municipal market, and it's following Treasuries down. But we also have a dearth of supply. This month, for example, expecting about $3 billion in new issuance, which is 50% less than last year at the same time. So we have a few added factors helping to push municipal rates down a little bit further than Treasuries have gone down so far this year.
All right. Thank you, Luther. That concludes our call. Please join us next month. Our call will be on Tuesday, October 7th at 9 o'clock as usual. And again, thanks for joining.